I was walking in today. I saw a monarch butterfly. That's a pretty big butterfly with an orange flapping along. A butterfly here in the middle of October is a good achievement, good thing. I guess I should say to you that many people who are away from home find holidays difficult, particularly Christmas break might be difficult for some of you if you can't go home. Don't think you're special if you find the holiday a little hard on the nerves. Others go home to their families and find it hard on their nerves too. That's another story. I'm going to start out today talking about dynamics. The goal of the work in dynamics is the derivation of the Maxwell-Boltzmann or Gibbs distribution. In order to get it properly, one has to have an argument which depends on how the particles move. Since you say that this distribution arises after the particles have been bouncing around for a while. I'm going to start out with a simple model called a random walk. The random walk will be today's thing. After that, we go to Brownian motion, which is less simple and was the subject of one of Einstein's great 1905 papers. And then we do the Boltzmann equation, which will give us an insight into how the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution arises. But a random walk. I'm going to have one coordinate for most of this. That coordinate I will call xj. I will use capital letters, I hope, for random variables, variables that take on some value depending upon what happens with a probability distribution. And I'm going to talk about the random variable x at time t. I'm going to imagine t is n steps times some characteristic time tau. And I will then say that this variable x is a sum of jumps, sigma j taking on the values plus or minus 1 at random, times a, where a sets the scale of length. And I will let j go from 1 up to n. Sigma j takes on these two values with equal probability. And I can, first of all, draw a picture of what happens. What happens is that you go one way, and then another way, and then another way, another way, another way, another way. Pretty soon, you may have gone a fair distance, but you've done it by jiggling up and back. The average distance that you traverse is obtained as the sum from j is equal to 1, j equals 1 to n, of the average of sigma j times a. And since sigma j takes on values plus or minus 1 at random, the average distance you traverse is 0. However, the mean square distance that you traverse, the average of x squared, is not 0. It's the sum from over j and k, a squared, two factors of a, sigma j times sigma k. The sigma j's are said to be identically and independently distributed, so that Sigma J does not correlate with sigma K. This is A squared times the sum over J of the average of sigma J squared. And since sigma J squared takes on the value 1 always, this is simply A squared times N. The maximum value that you could have for x of t, if all of the sigmas were plus 1, is A times N. The root mean square value of x of t, that is, the average of x squared square root, which gives us the typical distance which we travel, is A times the square root of N. Since the square root of N is very small in comparison to N, we don't travel very far. I have an example. Imagine that you go through 1,000,000 steps. Then the maximum distance you could travel is 1,000,000 times A, but the average distance, the typical distance that you travel, is 1,000 times A. That's 1,000 times smaller than the maximum distance. So you really go over distance, which is quite small in comparison. Now I'm about to state a result called the central limit theorem, which will enable us to determine the probability distribution for x of t. I will state it, but not prove it. The result is that as n goes to infinity, x of t is a Gaussian random variable. The theorem is that if x of t is a summation of pieces, xj, from 1 to n, and if the pieces, x is a sum of pieces that are, in the simplest point of view, IID, independently and identically distributed, but you don't need identically. Independent is quite enough. And the variance of x, small x, is bounded. That is, each x has a bounded variance, then it is true that capital X of t is a Gaussian random variable. Since this thing has variance equal to A squared, this is certainly a Gaussian random variable. And the probability distribution that we will find X of t equal to X, that is, that this random variable will turn out to have the value x, is given by the result that you expect for a Gaussian. It is e to the minus x minus the expectation value of x, which is 0, squared, divided by twice the variance. And the variance is a squared times n. And there is then in the denominator a 2 pi a squared n. At this stage, I have said almost everything there is to say about this case. I can rewrite this in a form which is perhaps better to talk about. If we're talking about going over an interval t, which is n times tau, what we see is this is the distance traversed divided by 2a squared, that is the distance per step, times t divided by tau, since that's what n is, divided by the square root of 2 pi a squared t over tau. So the distance you travel is going to be proportional to the time of travel square root. Typical time traveled is the square root of the typical distance traveled is the square root of the time traveled. Now, this is an interesting result. It had interesting consequences at the very beginning of the development of kinetic theory. Maxwell, among others, developed kinetic theory. That is, developed a theory which enabled him to talk about the property of gases dependent upon the view that gases were composed of zillions of molecules bouncing around in sort of random paths. That is, with x, y, and z coordinates, each of which was doing roughly this. Now, this enabled him to deal with a puzzle. The puzzle is that a typical velocity, this is the front board, so it's this one. Typical velocity for particles bouncing around is the speed of sound, which is 300, more or less, 300 meters per second, which is 3 times 10 to the fifth centimeters per second. I will work in CGS, even though the best international convention is to use meters. The problem is that if you imagine you had a bottle of some smelly stuff and you open it up here, and if the air in this room is still, it may take as long as half an hour, even longer, for the smell to get back to the back of the room. It will certainly take more than a few seconds to get to the front of the room. On the other hand, sound takes essentially no time in comparison to get to the back of the room or the front of the room. You hear me sort of immediately. How could it be that sound, or this suggests, and it is true, that the particles have a typical speed c? Not the velocity of light, but the velocity of sound. And smell moves much more slowly. Maxwell then argued that the particles are undergoing a random walk. They keep bumping into one another. They do this, and this slows them down. He then described things in terms of a lambda, which is a mean free path. And a tau, which is a mean free time. Mean free path means the mean free distance you travel between collisions. And from the data he had, he could guess I wrote it down. I did my homework. What's going on here? The mean free path, he could guess, as about 10 to the minus 7 centimeters. An atom is about 10 to the minus 8 centimeters, so that this is about 10 atomic distances. Most of the time, the particles are bouncing away around far from each other. This is talking about gases, like the air in this room. That means ten to the minus 9 meters, if you want it that way. That means you move in a straight line for this distance divided by the speed of sound. The time that it takes you before a collision is 10 to the minus 7 centimeters divided by 3 times 10 to the fifth meters per second. Centimeters per second, and you end up in units seconds. And you end up with 3 times 10 to the minus 13 seconds. That's the time between collisions. How many collisions do you undergo in a second? Well, in a second, you undergo the number of collisions in 1 second. Is 1 over this number, 1 over 3 times 10 to the minus 13th, which is 10 to the 13th, or 3 times 10 to the 12th collisions. When I started talking about what happened in 10 to the 6th collisions up there, I was talking about a relatively small number. This 3 times 10 to the 12th is a much bigger number. And what that shows you is that you can only move over much smaller distances. That is, in 1 second, you move over a distance lambda times the square root of n, 10 to the minus 7 seconds, times 3 times 10 to the 12th collisions per second. Square root thereof, 3 times 10 to the 12th collisions, no collisions per second. And that gives you the square root of n, yes. Okay, I wrote it correctly. That gives you a 10 to the 6th. The square root of 3 for the purposes of this calculation is 1. because we're not, I put a 1.7 down, but the inaccuracies are well beyond that, well beyond the difference between 1 and 2. And we get 10 to the minus 1 centimeters. So this is the distance you move in 1 second, and that distance grows as the square root of time. Yes? I'm sorry. You're pointing out an error, I suspect. Well, up louder. 300, 3 times 10 to the 4th. Thank you. The number was not coming out. This number was not coming out where I wanted it to be coming out. You go through the rest of the calculation, you get the right answer. The right answer is a little bit smaller distance than the distance that I gave here. Smaller distance. Well, the right answer is, I think, a smaller distance than the distance I gave here. My perfection leaves much to be desired. And thank you for correcting my error. I will not go over the stuff again. Error of a mere square root of 3, no, a mere square root of 10 or 3 in this calculation is not to be taken very seriously. Let me show you some pictures of what a random walk looks like. Imagine that we have 3 coordinates, x, y, and z, which are all doing this random walk thing. Since x, y, and z are supposed to be independent of one another, that means that the probability distribution for these guys are independent of each other. And the probability that r of t is equal to small r is given by a product of probability distributions for x, y, and z. That product of probability distributions is then given by, in the denominator, there is a 2 pi times t over tau times a squared raised to the 3/2 power, one such factor for each coordinate. And in the numerator is an exponential of r squared, that's x squared plus y squared plus z squared, divided by 2a squared times t divided by tau. And this is the probability distribution for a random walk in 3 dimensions, which I'm about to show you if I can get the computer to do it for me. First, let's turn on stuff here, HDMI. I'm in lecture 4. I click on random. All kinds of excitement. Okay, first up, as this, okay, we'll do the lights low. Once again, as I've done a million times, it seems like I will show you how long the program is, but not show you in any detail the program. There's this much program, and then we do it. Come on. Okay. What do I have up on the screen? There's a random walk that started from the blue square and ended up at the blue thing and ended up at a red thing, which is just off the screen on this picture. I will run the random walk again so you can see the whole thing. The size of the random walk is typically this size. Actually, we've been through 20 runs the time it took to produce this. And this is the average distance traversed. That's the old version of the program. The old version of the program, I had a square root of 3 wrong. In any case, in the up-to-date version of the program, these dots go experimental result is. This is the experimental result. This is the theory, and the two are very close to one another. I think I've got a mistake in the program by a factor of the square root of 3. This is the distance moved for one run as a function of steps. We go through each run 100 steps, and it turns out that the distance moved first goes up and then goes down and is as the particle returned pretty close to the origin. I'm going to show you the random walk again, just so that we have one that doesn't go off the screen, we hope. There's one that doesn't go off the screen. And with a little bit of luck, I will be able to turn it around so you can see it in 3 dimensions. There it is in 3 dimensions. So that's a random walk of 100 steps. As you can see from the step size, the distance between the red ball and the blue ball is much smaller than 100 times the step size. It is, in fact, 10 times the step size, or rather the square root of 3 times 10 times the step size. Maybe I didn't make a mistake in the program. Maybe N, which was 20 different steps the last time through, was too small to see a good comparison between the average distance, N. N being not the number of steps, but the number of different realizations, the number of different runs like this. There were 20 such runs. The last time through, there was a discrepancy between what the theory gave as an average, and what the numerical experiment gave as an average. This discrepancy has disappeared on this graph, but the theory is so simple that it's not worth struggling to figure out whether something went wrong or not. So this is what the random walk looks like in three-dimensional space. This is what Maxwell could visualize in his mind and what we have in front of us if we make a simple computer program for it. Questions or comments? Okay. I am going to then turn off the, put the lights up, shut down in 10 seconds. Go. This talk about random walk gives me an opportunity to talk about a subject which is very important in physics. And that has to do with conservation laws. If we have a quantity, Q, which is conserved, that means that Q of t has the derivative dq dt equals 0. What q might I look for here? It's not obvious. Here, q is the total probability the integral, if I'm working with a one-dimensional random walk, of rho of capital X equals X over all X values. This total probability is equal to 1, and clearly the time derivative of 1 is 0. Now, we know all about conservation laws because we've studied, all of us, electrodynamics, in which Q is the total charge, and the conservation law turns out to be of the form that there's a differential conservation law, which is the form the time derivative of rho plus the divergence of the electrical current, RT, plus the divergence of the electrical current is equal to 0. This statement is equivalent to this statement. However, I might argue that J was produced by the local conditions in the neighborhood of RT, and then the second statement has, with that proviso, more content than the first statement. All kinds of quantities have conservation laws. There's a conservation law for angular momentum. There's a conservation law for momentum. We're going to talk today about the conservation law for probability. We're going to be talking about the probability that X is equal to M times A, and that T is N tau. And we're going to talk about how this probability works. This is a one-dimensional example, and one-dimensional example has some advantages. We can visualize it better. We have a lattice here. And here, let us say, this is the value of M that we're looking at. This probability at M is produced because of the random walk rho of MA at a time n plus 1 times tau is produced by what happens at the time n times tau. It is produced because particles are hopping into this site and because particles are hopping out. However, to get rho, I just have to look at the particles hopping in. If I'm going to have particles hopping in from the left, there has to be particles at the point m minus 1 times a. And this happens at a time n times tau. And there's a 50-50 chance that the particle will hop in that direction. Nobody's sitting there. Can you see okay? Then there is the hop that comes in this way, and that's the same thing, 1/2 rho at the point m plus 1 times a and n tau. I'm going to rewrite it on another board because I don't like to work back there. I only have to come close to this. I don't even have to touch it. What a wise thing. Okay, so it's the second one that goes up. There. I'm going to recopy this equation and ask you to continue to think about that picture. Did I make a mistake?
Why is it a minus?
It's a minus because I spent too much time on airplanes. Thank you. There will be minus signs eventually, but not now. Thank you. So, with a little help from my friends, row at the point M and the time I'm just recopying the equation, and I want to get it right. I'd like to get this into a form that looks like it has differentials and derivatives in it. In order to do that, I will say that I want to talk not particularly about the probability that we have a particle there, but how that probability changes in the time between n and n plus 1. So I subtract out the probability at the earlier time, and I then subtract out, with a factor of 2, the probability at the earlier time here. I have done nothing but stick these terms into the equation, both on the right side and the left side. Another mistake, Horace. Thank you. Because all the particles leave. That is, the particle hops. It doesn't have the option of standing still. It has to hop. Therefore, all the particles leave. Every single particle at time t was someplace else at the earlier time.
We have some particle at this place, and like after one step of the time, some particles will come in and some particles will go out.
All particles will go out.
Every particle goes out. So the probability. However, I have sort of done what you wanted me to do, because here I say, well, let's subtract away what there was at the beginning. But every single particle that was present here at time n tau has left, so we don't have to watch, we don't have to put it in. So this is, you can think about, as the change in the amount of charge, or I guess I won't think about it as charge, but in the amount of rho that occurs. Now, in the electrical case, what we do is we would say something like the following. I want to think about the electrical case because most of us have spent more time thinking about electric circuits than we have thinking about probabilities. Imagine that we're talking about the charge here. What we think about is that the time derivative of the charge, which is sort of like this, is produced because there is a current coming in from this direction, and there is a current leaving in this direction. I will call those currents I minus and I plus. I plus carries charge out of there, hence the minus sign. I minus carries charge into there, hence the plus sign. My convention is that X goes that way, and that X is a positive direction. Similarly, I can say that there is a current for probability, and that this change is I minus. Minus I plus. And I can then identify the place at which the current occurs as here. The I minus is I minus of M minus 1/2 times A is halfway in between, and I'll call it N tau. And I plus is I plus of M plus 1/2 times A and N tau. And there is no reason for this minus or this plus when I write it as a function of coordinate. These things are just exactly the current that occurs at this place and the current that occurs in that place. The minus sign occurs because the current coming in from the left carries charge in. The current going out to the right carries charge out. Charge or probability, it is always the same thing. The current that we get at M plus or minus 1/2 times A and N tau is produced because there is a guy to the left pushing probability that way, rho M let me make it minus 1/2. There's a guy to the left pushing probability that way, M minus 1 A and N tau. But there's also now, as you pointed out, stuff going from here to here, and that has to be counted in the probability also. And there's a 50-50 chance that the guy sitting here will move in that direction, and that's rho of M times A and N tau. And the current, this is I minus I plus, which is the current at M plus 1/2 times A and N tau is equal to 1/2. This is just the current, so I know how to do that. This is M one step larger than before. So this is rho of M A N tau, and this is minus rho of M plus 1 A and N tau. And there's a 1/2 and a big parentheses and a 1/2 and a big parentheses. Now I'm about to differentiate. This thing is the difference, but this difference I can think of. Sorry, let's write this once more. This equation is just exactly the same thing as the change in rho is I minus minus I plus. And since I minus and I plus are the current just evaluated at different places, If the current is varying smoothly with respect to position, we can replace this difference by a derivative and this difference by a derivative. And we can replace this difference also by a derivative, that is a time derivative. I'm about to do that. This difference is the time derivative, time, that's time, of rho times tau, which is the time interval. So on the left-hand side of the equation, I get the time derivative of rho of ma and n tau times tau. That simply is the replacement of this difference by the appropriate derivative, or maybe you should say I differentiate with respect to tau here. And on the left-hand side, on the right-hand side of the equation, I had the derivative, I have a differential of I minus minus I plus. I move that to the other side of the equation and find that this is the derivative with respect to x, with respect to ma of I plus minus of I. Of ma and n tau, except that this is at 1/2 times a, so that this is 1/2 times that derivative. Nope, it's one. It should be one times the derivative. Thank you. Okay, let's do it slow. I plus of m plus 1/2 times a minus I minus of m minus 1/2 a, or I of m plus 1/2 minus I of m minus 1/2. There's a difference of 1 there, so that half that I was trying to put in comes half from this term and half from this term. Half plus half is 1, and this is equal to 0. And that's what we get. Yes? Derivative with respect. Correct. Thank you. And now we calculate what that current is. The current has in it also a difference of 1, but there is an explicit 1/2 in the current. The current is going to be equal to explicit 1/2, which is now correct, the derivative with respect to ma and an a, of I of rho of ma and n tau. with a minus sign. Put it all together, and you get the time derivative of rho on the other side of the equation, a squared, 1a from there, 1a from there, divided by tau, that's this tau, 2 from there, times the derivative with respect to x, x is ma, rho of x and t of x and t. So all of this was an exercise in calculating derivatives in terms of differences, assuming slow variation of the rho. This thing is called the diffusion equation. It has in it exactly the same content as Maxwell's argument about random walks, except that it is much more general. All kinds of things obey diffusion equations. I'll get you in a sec. I want to get I'm all wound up. All kinds of things obey diffusion equations. The flow of heat obeys the diffusion equation. The flow of momentum obeys the diffusion equation, at least the part of momentum which is transverse to the wave vector. Diffusion is a very, very common thing in the world. Your question. Diffusion is always second order on the x on the right-hand side. You have one derivative there, thank you. I feel like I am leading an orchestra. It's a good thing. That's fine. I love it. That's wonderful. I've had too much vacation travel, and I'm not doing so well. But you guys are doing well. It doesn't matter what I do. Which is you're the ones that are supposed to be learning things. Okay. Diffusion equation. I'm going to be talking about the diffusion equation for the next couple of minutes. The diffusion equation is something absolutely special. You all know that the laws of classical mechanics obey time reversal invariance. As do the laws of quantum mechanics. I'll do it for classical mechanics. In classical mechanics, the time derivative of the position is the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to p, and the derivative of the momentum, time derivative of the momentum is minus the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to q. There might be lots of p's and q's. Under time reversal invariance, q dot goes into minus q dot, because q dot is a derivative with respect to time. P goes into minus p, and this equation remains satisfied. P dot goes into p dot, because p itself flips, but so does the time derivative. On this side, everything is even. This equation is satisfied. Time reversal invariance is a good invariance of classical mechanics. It is also a good invariance of quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics involves e to the minus I some h times time divided by another h. Flipping the sign of I is equivalent to flipping the sign of t, and we all know that quantum mechanics is invariant under flipping the sign of I. Therefore, we have invariance in both quantum mechanics and classical mechanics. This equation does not appear to be, it is not, in fact, invariant under this kind of change. Change the sign of the time derivative. X remains the same blessed thing. T is changed. This left-hand side flips sign. This right-hand side remains the same. And this diffusion equation doesn't change. Unless we think maybe tau should change. But tau is the time between collisions. That time between collisions doesn't change at all. In fact, if we write the diffusion equation in the way it is usually written, in which we have a lambda, a diffusivity, times dx squared rho of x and t, or we have a dt rho is lambda times del squared rho of r and t. This thing flips sign under time reversal invariance. This thing remains the same. We don't have a time reversal symmetry. It is, however, even worse than that. Bye-bye. Let me take an equation that has time reversal symmetry. The wave equation certainly does. Oh, I'm sorry, sure. With a little bit of luck. Let's see. It was the last one, I think. Excuse me. Get rid of this one instead. No, I'll work there. Wave equation. Wave equation is peripheral to our interests at the moment, so put it on this board. Phi obeys. The time derivative minus c squared, this is now the velocity of sound or light, it doesn't make any difference, times del squared phi equals zero. I will think of it in the one-dimensional example in which this is dx squared. I can write the general solution of this equation for in one dimension as phi of x and t is some function of x minus ct plus another function of x plus ct. The wave is going in the plus x direction. The wave is going in the minus x direction. With an a and a b there, these are two general functions. Changing a into b and b into a is equivalent to changing the sign of the time. Since a and b are arbitrary, this is an equation which is quite invariant under changing the sign of the time. However, that's not true at all about the diffusion equation. Time derivative of rho plus is equal to lambda dx squared rho. I can write a general solution to this as e to the ikx, k is a wave vector, minus lambda k squared times t. You can, by differentiating with respect to x, you get from here a minus k squared because of two derivatives times lambda. So you get a minus k squared times lambda times this thing from here. And from here, you get the same thing. The time derivative gives me lambda times k squared. In fact, the general solution of the equation is rho of x and t is the integral dk. I'll call it rho tilde. That's the Fourier transform of rho at time equal to 0. This is the general solution of the equation. Now let's imagine we're taking positive time first. Positive time, the bigger the time gets, the better this converges for large k. integral decay goes from minus infinity to infinity, and large magnitude of k can possibly give us trouble, but doesn't give us trouble for positive t because this becomes exponentially small. For negative t, this term becomes exponentially large. It grows larger and larger and larger as k gets larger. That means any tiny stuff which exists at large values of k is tremendously magnified. The words that go with this tremendous magnification of small effects far away is that the problem is ill-posed in the sense of Hadamard. Hadamard was a person and a mathematician who said, how, among other things, how problems could go bad. This problem of the diffusion equation is ill-posed, badly described. If we set conditions at t equals 0 and look for t less than 0. This is then the characteristic of the diffusion equation, which makes it different from the wave equation. It is a little confusing how all of this happened. We started out with an x of t, which is the sum from j equals 1 up to n of a number, times sigma j, which took on the values plus or minus 1. This is t over tau. This looks rather symmetrical. And t goes into minus t. There's no obvious difficulty with this. You could change. You could do a continuation into negative t, negative n. All you have to do is change the sign of sigma j. Instead of saying it was plus or minus 1, you'd say it was minus or plus 1. Every time you gave it a plus 1 for forward motion in time, you'd give it a minus 1 for backward motion in time, and you'd have the same problem. At this stage, there's time reversal invariance. At the stage that we write down this, there's none. And what has happened is we have basically said we will look forward in time, we will not look back in time, and this equation forces us to make a choice. If we wanted to look backward in time, we could do the whole analysis once again, and there'd be a minus sign there. This equation, say it again, has no time reversal invariance. It describes what happens if we say what's going on at time 0 and then look forward, look after that time. The analogous equation, which would describe what would happen earlier in time, would have a minus sign, and we would say, let's look at what happens before. This issue about time reversal invariance has confused, interested particle physicists a lot lately. They have looked at how viscosity arises in a problem involving gravity in five dimensions. This is viscosity in the conformal field theory to 3-4-dimensional conformal field theory to 5-dimensional gravity. De Sitter, gravity in a De Sitter universe. they have been thinking about viscosity, but viscosity is an effect which occurs in a diffusion equation. Viscosity is a failure of, shows a failure of time reversal invariance, and then they have to worry about how the failure of time reversal invariance works itself out in quantum situation. I'm now going to show you some of the applications of diffusion equations. We have about half an hour, and I'm going to talk about applications. But you have a complete story here. And aside from getting my errors fixed up, which I thank you all for doing for me, I think it's a complete story. You may have questions about it, however, and I'd love to hear your questions. So I'm going to now switch back to the computer. HDMI, that's on. Light's low. Hide this stuff, hide this stuff. Okay, starting here. This is what I wrote about not being able to go backward in time in the diffusion equation. As you can see, if you read over it quickly, is the same thing as I said on the board. I'm then going to go on and talk about an application of random walks called DLA for diffusion limited aggregation. The picture that goes with DLA is that you have some pollution, some clot of carbon sitting here in the atmosphere. You have little pieces of soot going around doing random walks in the atmosphere. And when these little pieces of carbon land next to this big piece of soot, they stick on. And then more carbon comes, and the piece of soot grows bigger and bigger and bigger. This is called diffusion limited aggregation, and was the model was an invention of Tom Witten and Len Sander in 1981. This is almost the first physics problem which was stated as an algorithm. I will show you the algorithm on the next slide. The interesting thing about it is that it produces a very special kind of soot particle. This is a soot particle which is mostly air. It is all empty spaces. And these things grow out. And those things that grow out are emptier and emptier and emptier as they grow out. This is what's called a fractal. I'll talk to you about a fractal a little more in a moment, but let me show you the algorithm. Here is the Witten and Sander algorithm. It starts on the top. We have an aggregate, that is these red dots, and we have a new particle coming in from infinity. This new particle undergoes a random walk, that's what these blue arrows are about, until it gets to be a nearest neighbor site to the existing aggregate. It then sticks onto the aggregate, and we start with another particle undergoing its random walk and eventually sticking on. What we produce is something that you just saw, but I will then come back to it. No, not that way. Let's go this way. A very light structure in which these arms get less and less dense as they get further and further out. Structure which has the property of getting less dense as you get to more intricate behavior is called a fractal. This word fractal was invented by Benoit Mandelbrot to describe objects like this, and he made the case that such objects were often to be found in nature. Now I'm about to tell you something about fractals. Here's a picture, however, of another kind of fractal. This is a block of plastic. The actual block is about that size. You hold it in your hand. It's a good paperweight. And what happened to this block of plastic was that electrons from the Stanford Linear Accelerator were shot into the plastic. The electrons go in about a centimeter in depth and then come to a stop. They all come to a stop at roughly the same depth. Then somebody comes up to it and sticks a pin in the bottom of the thing. That pin then produces a path by which the electrons can leave this piece of plastic. They come shooting out of the plastic and form a pattern which looks like a rivers emptying out into the sea. This pattern is also fractal, has all kinds of small structure on top of the big structure. There is a big river and smaller rivulets and tiny little streams and tinier little stuff over there until all of the electrons are found and move out of the thing. Of course, this all happens in a fraction of a second. It says here that the diffusion-limited aggregation was related to the diffusion process, which I just described to you. That itself is related to a random walk process, but we knew all about that. I wanted to tell you a little bit about fractals. Let me use that board over there. Imagine that I have an object. Maybe the object is in three dimensions, maybe the object is in two dimensions, and the object is made up of smaller objects. That's what we've been talking about, stuff in which the big thing is made up of lots of smaller things. The big thing has size L. The small things have size A. And then the number of guys in this big thing is L over A raised to the power of the dimension of the system. That is, if this is a cube, the number of guys in it is proportional L over A cubed. If this is a square, the number of guys in it are L over A squared. If this is a line, the number is proportional to L over A. That, in fact, is where our words cube and square and linear come from, this algebraic behavior. If we see something like this, which is called a Sierpinski gasket, or something like this, or the diffusion-limited aggregate that I told you about, it is entirely possible, in fact, it is likely, that the number of guys in it is also of the form L over A to the D, but that D, for example, this two-dimensional diffusion limited aggregation, is not an integer, but is some number which is not an integer. The numbers that are quoted for diffusion limited aggregation range in the interval 1.65 to 1.71, as I recall. There's a measurement error, which is, does, I'm told, has disappeared recently, but I haven't seen the paper. So these fractal objects are described by a fractal dimension, and this nature is full of such objects which can be described by a fractal dimension. The Witten-Sander model calculation was interesting in large measure because it was the first example of a way of calculating a fractal object, a way of getting a fractal object, and that it was stated as one of the first cases in which some piece of physics came to us stated as a computer algorithm. Okay, that's one example of an effect of an application of random walks. I have a few more applications of random walks, which I'm going to talk about for a moment. Light's low. Many people assume that the price of something worthwhile, like a financial security, can be modeled by saying that the time derivative of the price of the security is a sum, is going to be one constant plus another constant times a random variable. Now, I haven't told you what eta of t is, but I'm about to do so. Eta of t is a Gaussian random variable with a very short correlation time. Eta of t is defined by being Gaussian. It is defined by having its average equal to zero and having correlations over very short times. Some constant here times delta function of t minus s. For literally hundreds of years, people have been modeling markets by saying that the probability of the price of a security is some constant alpha, which describes how the price is moving on the average, plus a constant beta called the described as the volatility, saying how random the price is, how much random fluctuation there is in the price of the security. People have said that, but in 1973, Black, Fisher, and Scholes figured out that you could use that idea of the fact that the price, the logarithm of the price of a security obeyed a random walk. That is, Gaussian random variable and random walk are the same thing. So that log rho of t obeys a random walk, rho being the probability of a price. They use that to infer the value of a what is called a derivative security. That is securities which are made up of the right to buy and sell other securities. Up until that time, nobody had developed a theory of what such derivative securities would be worth. In fact, there were few such securities because nobody could figure out what they were worth. And the theory then called into being a lot of marketing. People began to put together derivative securities, that is, the securities that had as their basic asset the ability to buy or sell other securities at a fixed price. And using the Black-Scholes theory, which is a theory of random walks, people then figured out what the price of the security would be, might be, and then used it to construct a market. Black and Scholes and Merton, who partially popularized this, Black, Scholes, and Merton, of course, understood this better than anyone. And they became major players in a firm called Long-Term Capital Gains, using the Black-Scholes theory. This firm made, over a whole bunch of years, 40% a year profit on the money invested in the firm, largely because they understood better what this Black-Scholes algorithm could do than other people. But then something funny happened. I'm not sure what says on the slide. I've forgotten what I wrote there. But something funny happened. There were enough other guys in the game doing the same thing so that they could no longer make that sort of profit on the market. Now, Long-Term Capital Management was a hedge fund. That hedge fund, when it got some competition, failed in a spectacular fashion. They lost $1 zillion and had to be bailed out by a whole bunch of other financial firms. The reason they lost the money is not entirely clear. They were buying securities that were related to the Russians and the value of the Russian debt. They may have in their last years worked on the basis of inside information from Russia. There are people who believe that that's what they were doing. And that was why they made the 40%, not at the beginning, but towards the end of their existence. They made the money in part, according to this argument, by getting inside information from the Russians. The guys who said they did it on the basis of inside information from the Russians also said that the Russians swindled them in the end. The Russians gave them wrong inside information, and that's why they lost $1 zillion, and the Russians made good money on that. That's what's said to have happened. No one can verify that. However, they did lose $1 zillion. The firm did go broke, and it did provide a precursor, a harbinger of things to come, which we have seen in the United States, and we are seeing happen in Europe. Firms making unwise bets on the market, and those unwise bets producing a bad outcome. That just proves, I guess, that all physics is not really tremendously helpful. It's helpful when you use it in a helpful fashion, and harmful when you use it in a harmful fashion. These guys were harmed by, and indeed the whole financial situation was harmed by the misuse of random walk algorithms. One last example, which I will talk about. We talked about how Boltzmann saw particles moving around in a random walk. Another thing that happened was that although Boltzmann saw it in his mind's eye, other people, in particular Alder and Wainwright, did computer simulations in which they had lots of particles. These particles bumped into one another and would produce, in the motion of the particle, the behavior of the gaseous system. I've lost where Hamilton's equations of motion were, but someplace on these boards there's Hamilton's equations of motion. Aldrin Wainwright took 600 particles in 1957. They took 600 particles, put them in a box, put periodic boundary conditions on the box, allowed the particles to collide by the laws of classical mechanics as applied to hard spheres, that is applied to particles with infinitely sharp, infinitely high repulsive potentials, and ran it through millions of collisions to see what would happen. Indeed, there were a couple of surprises in their work. For one thing, a orderly state, a state with a phase transition, was produced when the density was pushed up high enough. You could see something about the order in the state from this picture that I copied out of the internet. There's an orderly relation between the direction of one guy to his nearest neighbor, one guy to the nearest neighbor, one guy to the nearest neighbor. There are six special axes, and that these axes extend over the entire system. This particular kind of ordering is not exactly the usual liquid gas ordering, but it is an ordering that apparently does occur in a solid or liquid crystal, which is actually what this is technically, liquid crystal to gaseous phase transition that these guys discovered. They also discovered that if you looked in the flow behind any one of these particles, the time dependence had a sort of wake behind the particles, which looks like the wake behind a speedboat. These two things, the phase transition from the liquid crystal to the gaseous state, and the existence of a wake in the dynamics, were surprising discoveries that these guys produced from their studying of the molecular dynamics, that is the correct molecular dynamics, the correct dynamics which describe how molecules move through a gas. Well, not exactly correct. Molecules aren't exactly hard spheres. The collisions aren't exactly classical. They're more they have quantum mechanical cross sections involved in them. Nonetheless, qualitative properties, important qualitative properties of two-dimensional systems were discovered by these guys just doing simple computer simulations of very small systems, 600 particles in the first case. Here were then our three examples of the use of random walk ideas in the development of technology or physics or applied physics. Next time, we will go on to talk about how a random walk occurs in momentum space for a Brownian particle, that is a particle that is being hit by many other particles. After that, probably not in that lecture, but probably in the one following, we will talk about Boltzmann's discussion of how the Boltzmann distribution occurred when you looked at the collisions among particles in a gas. Questions or comments? Thank you one and all for rescuing me.